Merry Christmas! I feel like I can actually say this because I'm recording this on Christmas Eve, so it couldn't be any closer to Christmas. I hope you're well. I hope you're safe. I hope you have a lovely few days planned. If nothing else, just take a moment to stop and exist if you can, because I think that's really, really important, just to kind of recalibrate and go take a breath before we start a brand new year. I just wanted to say, actually, we've got one more episode before the end of the year where I'll say my proper thanks. But I just wanted to say thank you, really, for your continued support, for choosing to listen to the podcast. I know that in this busy market of podcasting, there is a lot of choice out there. So Ben and I really, really appreciate you taking the time to listen to us. It's not taken for granted in any way, shape or form. So thank you. It's a very welcome return to the podcast today to soundtrack into the fabulous Christy Wilson-Cairns, who joins me to discuss her script for the excellent Netflix vehicle, The Good Nurse. Starring Jessica Chastain and Eddie Redmayne, The Good Nurse tells the story of Amy, who's a nurse who suspects that her co-worker is a serial killer. He goes by the name of Charles Cullen. And just before we get into the first cue, I just wanted to say that I love this conversation with Christy, and we don't have many writers on the show. We have a lot of directors, writers, writer-directors. But if for anybody who is starting out or wanting the encouragement to take that step into the world of screenwriting, whatever angle you may be coming at it from, I think Christy's conversation today is utterly inspiring. Her enthusiasm for what she does and her love, pure joy for what she does, is infectious. So I hope for any aspiring screenwriters out there, you find this an inspiration, because I definitely did. I came away from our conversation going, right then, what am I going to write? Anyway, let's get back to The Good Nurse. It's scored by Biosphere, which is the moniker of Norwegian composer Geir Jensen, and we'll begin with a little excerpt of his musical suite from the film. This is really exciting, Christy, because we get to welcome you back to Soundtrack, and congratulations on The Good Nurse.
Thank you.
Which is your latest piece of writing, which is amazing, actually. I was lucky enough to did a Q&A with Eddie maybe about a month ago. It was so brilliant to get the chance to pick it apart a bit, because, well, tell me how the project came to you and stuff, and how you approach two things, actually, because there's a massive world of this whole kind of, you know, real crime, but then how you approach a book.
The Good Nurse was the first thing I ever wrote. It was the first thing I was paid to write professionally.
This is amazing.
So about 10 years ago, I signed with an agent in America, and I got sent like a stack of books as tall as I am, which is not very tall, granted, but still. And amongst it was The Good Nurse. And I remember kind of picking up and being like, oh, I don't know if I want to do a kind of salacious true crime story, but I thought I'll read the first chapter and then pass with authority. And the book's so good, I read the whole thing in one sitting. And I remember as I was going through it, I was like, I've got no idea how you tell this story, because the book is about Charles Cullen's life. It's about the serial killer's life. And in the last third, you reach this woman, Amy Loughran, who's like working class, single mum, working nurse, terrible health issues, not supported by the hospital she works for, and she's going to have to work with the police to turn in this guy who she thinks is her best friend.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh shit, well that's amazing.
Yeah.
But I had to pitch that, and there was like, at one point there was 8 other writers pitching for it. I've no idea who they are, I'm sorry.
Wow.
I'm sure they had good takes as well. But it was like a real gauntlet, and I remember I was pitching to Darren Aronofsky and his development team. And I think I was 23 at the time, like, and I was like really green. I didn't really know what I was doing. So every time in a pitch, I was like, you guys would be crazy if you made the story any other way. Like, this is the most interesting story.
Go in there ballsy and like, you know, confident.
Gallus, as we would say. Gallus, as my mum would call it. But yeah, and then eventually, you know, it got down to the last two, and then it was just me. And then they flew me out to New York, and they were like, okay, you're going to do research. And I'd never been to New York before. I was flown out, I was given a company credit card. I was like, oh my God. I was just basically, me and the author got drunk a lot. And in the space where we got drunk, he basically introduced me to the cops, to the relay mate, to the nurses that he'd worked with.
Oh my God.
I did 2 weeks of night shifts in a burn unit in Connecticut, dressed as a nurse, shadowing nurses, put my hand inside people. So it had a huge kind of like run up. And then we got the script together and we didn't have a director. And so it sort of languished for like 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then one day I got a phone call from the producers and they were like, oh, have you seen Tobias Lindholm's work? And I was like, yes, loved. I mean, I loved Hijacking.
Yeah.
I was very excited. And I know his work from, because he was a writer as well. And so he came on board to direct it. And then he was like, well, we're going to do it this way. We're going to get Eddie. We're going to get Jessica. And I was like, here it is. Okay. No problem. And then, so yeah, we had the script. We had like the team. And then like funding fell apart. Schedules came. So then it disappeared again.
Oh my God.
And then 2 years after that, I got a phone call from him. He's like, are you interested in taking this back up again? And I was like, yes. Because I'd met the real Amy and she's an incredible woman.
Yeah.
And I thought, I'd really love people to know her story. And so I got a load of help from the real Amy, from really great producers, great director. Eddie and Jessica are phenomenal. So and we did rehearsals together. So we changed the script together.
Wow.
So it was a real collaborative process. So it was a long term coming, but worth it.
Yeah. I think it's so interesting for people as well. Listen, it's our love. With this podcast, you can kind of peel back the curtain a bit for people because we go to the cinema and we watch these films and you don't really think about the journey to that point on screen.
Yeah.
And also I think people assume like with writers, with scripts, you write the script and that's you. Have a nice time making the film. See you later. And that is the case sometimes.
Yeah.
But this clearly was not the case and you were through that entire process.
Yeah, no, it's been, I don't know what it is about me. I think it's because I carry a lot of Haribo in my pockets. I always get taken onto set. Sam genuinely, when we were shooting.
Bringing the snacks, everyone.
I'm always bringing the snacks. During 1917, we'd be like shooting and Sam would be like, come here. And I'd like run over. I'd be like, what do you need? And he's like, got any Haribo? And I'm like, yeah, okay.
Words and Haribo, come
yes.
on.
Oh, yeah, yeah, you know, words and Haribo. That's what I should have in my business card. Sponsor me, Haribo. Kids and grown-ups love it, so can we name check them? But yeah, so I think it's that. But I've been every day in 1917, every day in Last Night in Soho, every day in The Good Nurse. I've been out the whole time. And I think it's really useful to have a writer on set because everyone's doing a lot.
Yeah.
There's a lot going on and having someone there that's just like, oh, we should think about the story. And that, like, working close with editors, working close with everyone in post-production as well, it's really good fun. I love it. I like the collaborative nature of it.
Does that mean that there's a want in you to encompass more of that, to direct and stuff as well?
I mean, maybe. That's something I've really been considering. I'm not naturally, like, I've never gone, when I started out, being like, I think I should be a director. I was really interested in watching and learning and listening. Yeah. And I love my job right now, but I think if the right project came along where it felt really personal, I'd give it a go.
Yeah.
Why not? I mean, like having Sam and Edgar, Tobias as a sort of, you know, people coaching you and helping you and giving you advice, it's not a bad position to be in.
Absolutely. It's so interesting because you were so, because of the research and this journey that you were on as well with the writer of the book, but then with the real Amy and stuff, did music come into any of those conversations at all?
So not until Tobias came on board. And I love music. Like, I can't really go anywhere without listening to music, but I can't write with music.
Mm-hmm.
So I write in silence and I never really think about it apart from with Edgar, because it was such a crucial part.
Yeah.
We wrote the scenes to the tempo of those songs, and scenes were the length of certain songs for Last Night in Soho. But that was the first time it ever really figured. But when Tobias came on board and he was like, listen, Biosphere are going to do it, I instantly realised that this was not going to be the traditional composition that films are. And I think that, especially when we did the final rewrite before you go on set and you go and shoot it, that let me be a bit more sparse with the dialogue, because I thought of there's an emptiness to a lot of his music that you get to fill with emotion.
Thank you.
I don't know much about music. I can't speak in a technical term, yeah. but I can understand it in a sort of emotional yeah. term. So for me, it was always that. And so, yes, it does have a hand in it, but in the very early stages, no. Unless I'm writing a very specific car chase where I'm like, yes, I'm going to have this in it.
Did she talk about music at all in terms of, you know, as the pair of them being friends and spending time together and, you know, did they ever go to concerts? Did they listen to music together and all that kind of thing?
Well, there was a lot of them driving in the car together.
Yeah.
And there was like earlier drafts of the script. Her in real life, she drove a white Jaguar, like this beat up white Jaguar, and I always thought cool. it was such a weird, like, and also because you're like, it's like upper, well, east coast of America, so it's like weird to just find this yeah. random white Jag. And she was like, and her and Charlie, and they would go in there and they would sing, and it was like, you know, everything that was on the radio the day.
Yeah.
But she talked about how the radio was her main companion because she would drive 3 hours back and forth, like to work.
Wow.
So, which is crazy to us because I can't imagine driving 3 hours anywhere. I mean, to Scotland, yes, but that's about it.
Yeah.
But every day. And so she had like a real relationship with that. And she used to tell me when she was driving, like she would talk back to the radio because she was so sleepy. So she would pretend that she was having conversations because wow. she'd worked like 3 night shifts in a yeah. row and would roll the windows down and just would be belting out at the top of her lungs. But that, I suppose, when it came to their relationship, I think we didn't really want to date it.
Yeah.
And as soon as you put that Absolutely. Kind of radio in there, it sets a sort of precedent. And what was really interesting to me about this was, yeah, okay, it happened in the early noughties, mm-hmm. but it can still happen today.
Yeah.
And so we had a lot of conversations about what do we do? And that was why Biosphere was so perfect, because it's sort of...
Yeah.
His music is a bit timeless.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel as well like the film, you know, with everything that's going on in the world and, you know, as we're recording this, yesterday was the nurses yes. were striking.
Yeah.
And I know that this story's set in America, but if nothing else, it really highlights the job.
Yeah. I mean, to me, I had no idea how manual nursing was. Because, yeah. like, you have this sort of notion of, like, them dabbing your brow when you've got a fever and you're like, oh, yeah. But when they actually were like, no, you're going to help me shift this man so that we can clean behind him.
Yeah.
Like, we need to change these sheets. And some of these people, I mean, even just shifting a normal size body is hard. Like,
yeah.
when it's not kind of like conscious, when it's not working. And then counting the fact that in America, they're usually much larger, as we are getting over here now yeah. as well. And then also when they're in pain, they fight you because they don't know.
No, yeah.
And so it's like, you know, nurses with black eyes. It's like a regular thing.
Wow.
And it's crazy to me. That's just not more of an education. Also, I really believe, and call this the socialist in me, that the way that the healthcare system's built in America, like profits ahead of patients,
yeah.
allowed Charles Cullen to kill so many people yeah. for such a long time. And if we're not careful, profits will be more important than patients in the NHS.
Absolutely. Well, I almost feel like he's almost not the villain in it.
No.
In a way. Like that woman who
yeah,
plays
yeah.
there, and she's a real person, isn't she? And she's now like the head of...
Yeah.
It's not.
It's crazy how... I'm not allowed to say too yeah, much because okay. they sue me. okay. They're very angry, the hospitals, apparently, allegedly. But in Charles Graeber...
She'd be sorry, really.
I know.
Angry,
you think they would be a bit embarrassed.
yeah.
Like, oops.
Yeah.
But in Charles Graeber's book, which is phenomenal,
yeah.
he lists where everyone kind of went to, where they all end up. And it's really alarming. It's really yeah. alarming how people get promoted after what they've done. But yeah, my big thing, what really interests me about this was it's a movie where you catch the serial killer, but the villain, the big villain, is still at large and is yeah. still at large today.
Yeah.
And that felt like a really good thing to be involved in.
it's so nuts to think as well that if you work in that system, you're not covered for that system. Is that not just the weirdest?
It's bonkers.
Couldn't get, because like when I was watching the film and I was kind of like, hold on, she's a nurse and she's not. It's like, it's crazy.
Yeah, she told me, you know that scene where she goes and she has to split her medical bill on two credit cards? I mean, she was like, that was like a once a month thing. And I was like, could you imagine?
Oh my God.
And she's like, and that's why she'd left it longer than she should have left it. Because she, you know, yeah. Like all these problems. And it's the same all over America. But it was like, the stuff I found out is extra to have the sirens on in an ambulance.
What?
Your face is the face everyone makes when I drop that. But yeah. It was like $500 extra if you want. They ask you, if you're conscious, they ask you if you want the sirens on. It's going to cost you more.
Like you're on a theme park. That's insane.
Do you want the picture as well?
Do you want a digital copy or an actual physical copy? And we're laughing, but it's just because it's so
terrifying.
Absurd.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I weirdly just had a flashback of that. I can't even remember what it's called now, but there was, when I was growing up, there was this really, probably like really unhealthy to watch now, but there was a comedy, a film about ambulance drivers in the States that I think either Richard Pryor or Eddie Murphy was in, and it was about them, you know, that kind of whole depot of where the ambulances get called out from and stuff like that. I can't remember what it was called. It's like the equivalent of like police academy, but ambulance kind of things. And I bet you if you looked back on that now and the kind of ridicule of what they were highlighting, it's probably actually, this is still going on.
Yeah. No, I'm sure it's still awful.
Man. It's interesting as well how much research you do, you know, in terms of really putting yourself in those situations. And I imagine that with each project, the opportunity for that is very different. You know, I mean, 1917, there was obviously research you could do, but to a point.
I guess. Well, I mean, 1917, a lot of it was the Imperial War Museum. A lot of it was like quite bookish research. But then I walked the route the boys take in France. I took my mum. Because she was like, oh, you can't go on your own. And I was writing it as I was kind of walking. So we were going, like, every 2 days, we were going to a different, like, hotel as we were moving across.
Oh,
and
wow.
And as you walk, you just see graveyard after graveyard after graveyard. And the thing that that gave me that none of the books really had was I had thought of the men that went to war as men. Because, you know, when you learn about it at school, they're older than you.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, I would have been 28 at the time that I was doing this. And there was no one older than me in any of those graveyards. And there was like 16-year-olds. And I just remember like sort of dragging my mum across this and her just weeping the whole way. And I was like, we've got to get through this. But it was really like, I'm laughing, but it was a really profound moment where you understand like, oh no, this has to be better. Like this has to like be personal. It has to really grow. You have to understand this cost.
Mm.
So that was, for that was really helpful.
Were you listening to music on that walk?
I did, yeah. I listened to a lot of music to try and cheer myself up.
Mm-hmm. Counteract what you're experiencing.
Yeah, yeah. And it was a lot of Soul Wax, which
nice.
I absolutely love. I'm like a sub-club techno kind of fan. So I listened to a lot of that. And then, so my gran used to sing to me. So when I grew up, we didn't have a lot of music in my house. My grandfather was deaf. My mum's profoundly deaf.
Oh, wow.
So I didn't have like a stereo and everything until I was like 13. Like it was just sort of like not really a factor. But my gran used to play these old records and they were always like either ABBA or like opera.
Okay.
And so my gran used to sing Madame Butterfly all the time. Oh. She used to like hum along in the kitchen. And so a lot of the times, and it makes me incredibly sad, Madame Butterfly, because it's very sad music. So a lot of the times, like I would listen to that to also just like expunge the sadness, to just like cry it out. But it was like the music in that became either like something like a balm to really like hold you whilst you were writing it, because it's so sad, it's so grim, it's so unrelentingly like awful what happened to these men and women and all of that section of the world. Or it would become like the thing that you needed to just get it out, so that then you could sit down and write. Because there would be times where I'd be writing where I would just be like just crying,
yeah,
and I'd be like, this is great. It's working, but also like help. But with Last Night in Soho it was totally different, because with Last Night in Soho Edgar gave me the music in advance. Like I had the playlist when I sat down to write it. So we would write in Soho, as you do, and I would cycle in playing the songs like There's a Ghost in My House and everything like that, which is like such a banger. Or even just Last Night in Soho.
Yeah.
And I would come and listen to that, and I would feel really excited and really alive, and it would like G me up for the day every day. And even we would listen to the music at lunchtime when we got a bit, you know,
yeah,
the slump happens.
Yeah.
And be like, let's bang on Puppet on a String. Yeah. Just like, and eventually we'd played Puppet on a String so many times in the office we were in that people came to complain. And it wasn't that they were complaining it was too loud, but they were like, just play something else.
Please, no more Sandy Shaw, thanks.
Totally.
Yeah.
The research for Last Night in Soho, I had sort of lived a lot of it because I know what it's like to be a young woman in a sort of industry where you're sort of preyed upon. I lived in Soho. I lived above a strip club opposite where we're recording this right now, and I worked in the Toucan. So a lot of that was like my own life. So it didn't require a huge amount of research, although we had a really incredible like book made that was about kind of women in the 60s in here in particular.
Yeah.
And then with Good Nurse, it was like long, unrelenting working night shifts in a hospital, really sad. And then listening to a lot of I'm trying to think, I was listening to a lot of Elliot Smith at the time to cry a lot. And then because I would like, it was in Connecticut, the hostel I was working at, and you would start at 7 o'clock at night and you'd finish at 7 o'clock in the morning. Wow. And it was January, it was so cold, and I was driving this like knackered rental car where you had to like, you know, you couldn't plug your phone in directly, so you had to like tune the radio to your phone thing. Yeah. I was like really, it's how long ago it was. And I was like just dying for anything fun. And I would listen to like just like stupid songs that, you know, you would play with your friends when you were on holiday.
To take you there.
My God, a lot of that. And a lot of the Charlie's Angels soundtrack.
Oh wow. The
Drew Barrymore, Lucy Liu.
Oh, amazing. Yes. Was that like Destiny's Child and stuff like
Destiny's
that?
Destiny's Child. Yeah. The Prodigy.
Oh wow.
Like it was like that was like the like a real formative soundtrack of my youth.
Yeah,
oh
yeah,
my
yeah.
God. It's phenomenal. It's really good. It's really good.
Mentioned Madam Butterfly, did you see White Lotus? Have you been up to speed on White
Lotus? I'm not up to speed on White Lotus because I've basically been a hermit writing for the last week, but now I'm free and I'll be watching White Lotus.
There's a Madam Butterfly.
Oh no. I have to prepare
moment.
Myself for that.
You were really well.
But like
in that it's extraordinary.
Imagine me just sobbing somewhere. Just
like, yeah. Sorry.
No, it's
maybe wait till after Christmas.
Yeah, I'll wait. I'll do Boxing Day when I'm be depressed anyway. Oh no, wait. Hang on. New Year's Day. That's the best one, isn't it?
That's so crazy. It's amazing because the way that music works in film, I think, is so you know, I love that every time I get to speak to someone about it for this podcast, it's like, I love the stories and I love learning more. But that those two things that they are, where there's those score moments. But like you say, with that, with the Charlie's Angels, it's that collection of songs. And it's the choice of putting things together and what it creates and the memories that it creates, you know, in terms like, I want to feel this way, so I'm going to play that. It's amazing, isn't it?
No, it's really, I get very angry because musicians can do with a chord what it usually takes me a whole scene to do. And I'm very jealous. I'm not in any way musically gifted. Like, I'm the exact opposite. I remember my mum was like trying out music lessons and stuff on me, and like every single one of them was like, she's not got it. Like third one in, they were like, we could take your money, but like honestly, kids tone deaf. My mum was like, tracks. Even drums. I don't have rhythm. I can't dance. I'm a terrible dancer as well. So it's like,
no one's a terrible dancer.
Oh no, you wait till you see. I'll do it for you right now. I'm not embarrassed about it, but like, I've seen videos of me dancing. I'm like, oh, her. It's a shame for her. But yeah, no, I feel that what they can achieve and how they can achieve it is magic. It is alchemy.
Mm.
And the ability to do that. I mean, I always remember in 1917, there's a particular part of the script that I love. You always have one bit of the script you're just like, oh my God. And as a writer, you're like, they'll never pull this off. They'll never pull this off as good as I've written it.
Oh, I like you testing always, them. That's brilliant.
And I say that to them. I've said that to Roger Deakins. I was like, this can be as good as I've imagined it. And then I see it and I'm like, shit, okay. But there's a bit in 1917 where George McKay's character gets shot in the head. The helmet comes off and then he wakes up.
Yeah.
And it's like him walking down. It's nighttime and he comes down and they're like, the flares burst over the village. And it's this ruined village. And I remember when I wrote it, I was like, oh my God, like, I can't wait to see what Sam, what Roger, what they all do with this. And there was a temporary, so we shot it and I was like, slayed. And there was a temporary music track on it, which was another of Thomas Newman's tracks, but they'd just thrown it on it when we were watching it in the dailies. And I was like, oh my God. And I remember saying to Sam, I was like, you can't top this music. I was like, you just like, and he was like, I think we'll license it. Like, there's no way you can do better.
Mm.
And then maybe about 5 days later, Sam phoned me and he was like, you need to come and see this. Like, he's done it. And I remember, and it's one of my, it's called The Night Window. And I remember kind of watching it and just being like, oh my fucking God.
Yeah.
And it's a part in the movie that I watch where I forget I've written the movie. Like, I forget that I know what's coming.
Yeah.
And that's, don't get me wrong, that's Roger, that's Sam, that's George, that's the incredible team. But it's mostly Thomas Newman. It's mostly that alchemy, that magic.
Wow. That's incredible.
It's
the magic of cinema, isn't it?
I hate them that they're so special that they can do this. Damn you, musicians.
But they needed your words to be able to do it for the inspiration.
Yes, sure.
There's something about, like, I just watched All Quiet on the Western Front.
Oh, yeah.
And when you were talking about that notion of how young, and it's so interesting because we never really get to see the other side.
No.
But this film does. And just the kind of, you know, and I think now more than ever as well, we kind of need reminding of kind of, you know, the tragedies of war and how unnecessary it is. And I think that to be able to do that through such a beautiful art form, both with that film and even just that, you know, that scene that you talk about and how brilliant 1917 was. It's something that I think needs to be kept being told in a way.
Yeah, I mean, I always think I'm really interested in World War II, particularly women in World War II, because I think those stories are very rarely told. And if they're told, they're not told through a female gaze ever, which is frustrating because a lot of the women in World War II were James Bond, and you've never heard of them.
Well, like Margot Robbie's character in Amsterdam as well, I thought was a great example.
Exactly.
Of it. It's kind of, I just thought that was so fascinating, and getting the chance to speak to David about her and how much research he did into the women who were, that she was based on, is like, God, she was real.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's unbelievable, and it's largely absent. Like, it's largely absent, which is something that I'm always like kicking around. But there's always a sort of accusation of like, we've got enough war movies, but we're still going to war, so we've clearly not.
Yeah,
and I think see when we don't fight anymore, like see when that's not an option, when it's not, it's not even, it shouldn't even be a last resort essentially, but it is, and it has to be because of the way we are. But like, I think see when we've got there, then we've had enough war movies.
Yeah,
like then okay, call it a day, we fixed it.
Yeah. Yeah, but until then, yeah, keep them coming.
Yeah.
It's amazing watching what you've written as well, because it's just, it's such a vast, you know, in terms of the kind of the scale of things as well, and the goodness and hearing about the amount of work that went into it. But it's such a personal performance and stuff. It's quiet, and it's kind of, you know, it's close. And that's amazing to kind of see the diversity of what you're able to do. How do you know, and how do you make the choices, and what's going to be next, or what you want to do next? Or...
I think like it's. I mean, for so much of your career, you're just like, oh my God, I'm working, haha. Like, and then there's a while where you're like, oh my God, they're paying me well. And then I've been very lucky in the last 3 years where it's like, now you get to choose. So I set up my own production company, partly because I wanted to have more control, but partly also there's stuff I want to see that I shouldn't write. There's stuff about like the black female experience.
Yeah.
There's stuff about that I'm like, why? Is no one making this? Why can't I watch it? And I know I shouldn't write it. I don't have that point of view. It's not.
Yeah.
I wouldn't do it justice. Mm-hmm. And so it's like setting up a company to allow that kind of thing to happen. It's really exciting. So that happens as alongside my stuff. And it's like you've got some kind of small amount of power. How do you throw it around?
Yeah.
How you throw it around so that you can see other worlds that aren't traditionally told. So there's that. But I think when it comes to me choosing stuff, a lot of it's who I'm working with, because I'm really lucky. I've had like fantastic relationships with directors, and to, like work with them again and finding new directors that are like that. I always make a list. I'm like, oh, I'd love to see if I can get in a room with them.
Yeah.
And I give it to my agents and they're like, they're going to be in town. And I'm like, let me get drunk with them. I can sell myself. I
won't dance, but I'll get drunk.
I might dance, but they'll be drunk enough that it won't matter at that point. But a lot of it's also... I have this rule, you shouldn't write a movie that you wouldn't watch hungover on a Sunday morning, which I know is a strange rule, but I believe that that's the truest version of you, or it's the truest version of me anyway.
I'm here with you.
What you want to watch then is kind of like what soothes you, what engages you, and what takes you out of yourself. So if I'm offered stuff, I usually think, oh, do I want to see this? Mm-hmm. Do I want to watch it then? And obviously there has to be a kind of degree of creativity in it. You want to be like, okay, what muscle can I flex?
Yeah.
What can I do now? What can I do that's really different? But a lot of it's just like, what does this do in the world? What does it say?
Yeah.
Does it make someone's life a bit better? Because movies were such a, like, movies saved me.
Yeah.
Like, I grew up watching film and TV. Like, I had a really happy childhood, but both my grandparents got Alzheimer's when I was 13, and my mum and I cared for them on our own. Wow. And so, like, and movies were like total escapism. It was the only chance that we all got away.
Kind of thing?
I mean, do you know, a lot of it was like Police Academy. I used to go to Global Video in Shawlands, and I rented Police Academy so much that they gave me the VHS of Police Academy. I still remember my membership number, 739, Global Video. And I would go in, and like literally every day after school, and like pick up, you know, they do like 3 for 2, pick up 3 for 2, take it back the next day, and just like constantly on repeat. And it was, a lot of it was like Airplane, Mel Brooks, mm-hmm. like really like daft, like History of the World. I could quote verbatim. I could do it right now. I won't. You're welcome. And then other things, I suppose, and I get laughed at a lot for this, because you should say, oh, it was the German New Wave and 400 Blows and that spoke to my soul. But actually, the first Charlie's Angels movies made me want to work in film or be a Charlie's Angel. And I did not have the language skills to be a Charlie's Angel. So I ended up in film. And so like movies like that and like Underworld, I would go and watch Underworld with my mum and we would come out the cinema like as if we were vampires. Like you would feel, and mm-hmm. to see women in positions of power was kind of rare.
Yeah.
Like to see female superheroes wasn't really that yeah. common when I was younger. And so I guess a lot of what I want to do now is like not necessarily female superheroes, but superhuman women.
Yeah.
You should know their stories about. But movies essentially taught me how to live. They taught me how to like exist, and they were sort of like meditative mm-hmm. in that way as well. I kind of what I want to make is, yeah, you want to make things that are important, but you want to make something that someone wants to watch 40 times.
Yeah.
So that Global Video, RIP, give them it.
I used to have this weird thing. I used to do it at night. I had this wee TV and a VHS player in my bedroom that my dad had got like secondhand. And I had a VHS copy of The Blues Brothers.
Uh-huh.
And I used to, every night from about the age of 13, I'd put it on. And I'd go to sleep with it on. Yeah. And my mum or dad would have to come and switch the telly off every night sort of thing. It's weird, but I absolutely hear that kind of, what you're saying about it being transportative and just kind of taking you out yourself and taking you to a bigger world.
Yeah. Well, because, you know, like I grew up in the south side of Glasgow. It wasn't a big world.
Yeah.
And also I was very privileged. Like, you know, I went to a private school and everything like that. I had like the best possible start you could get, but I had that because my grandparents worked really hard and mm-hmm. I was like partly a scholarship kid. And so you would read books and you would hear about this bigger yeah. world, but it was like, could you get there?
Mm-hmm.
But films could take you there. I mean, I remember watching Titanic. My mum took me out of school to watch Titanic.
Yes.
And I was like,
I've done that with white.
Do you know what? A lot of my like most kind of favorite memories with films in the cinema is my mum, like turning up at school at lunchtime, being like, oh, there's, I've got to take her. There's been a bereavement or an accident or something. And then going and seeing like just terrible films a lot of the time, like a lot of really bad movies, which I was about to
do. You need to see the bad with the good. That's
the
thing.
You do, yeah, yeah, you do. And then like these epic blockbusters. Like I remember she found out one time Jurassic Park was being played again at the GFT out of school. Yeah. She's like, you got to see it in the big screen.
Big screen?
Yeah, yeah. Totally. She's like, you have to. And it was so important to have the other world shown to you and also other people's life experiences.
Yeah.
I mean, I met very few people outside my bubble in Glasgow. And so like to watch If, to watch those kind of yeah. films, you'd be like, wow, okay, that's what yeah. it's like.
Yeah, absolutely.
Really profound.
Yeah. You said that you came in and you were like proper skipping your step because you just finished a script, which I'm assuming you can't tell us what it is or what it's about.
I can tell you after they stop. Yeah. after the recording stops.
After recording. So yeah, you need to wait for the next episode of Christy to find out what it is. How does it work? Do you work on one thing at a time or can you have kind of plates spinning?
No, I think I've got quite a strange brain and I like to do three projects at a time. I like how you laughed there. You're like, yeah, you do.
My last radio producer had, Mick, was just kind of like, I think you're definitely on the spectrum because I've never seen anybody be able yeah. to function a radio desk and screens in as many ways as you can.
I find it incredibly soothing for my brain to be at capacity. If it's my brain's not at capacity, like it'll act out.
Yeah.
I found that I've got ADHD during the pandemic. Like literally I was like, oh, okay, that does track. And they yeah. were like, you probably like had this at school and weren't doing well. And I was like, I did very well at school, thank you very much. Do you want to see my standard grades? Yeah. But it was quite, I suppose, enlightening to find that out, but yeah. also it didn't change anything because yeah. I already knew that my brain didn't work right. But I like to have them in different stages. So I'll have something that I'm researching.
Mm-hmm.
Which actually, sometimes it's two or three things that I'm researching until I really settle on it. And then I'll have something that's like first draft stage.
Yeah.
And then I'll have something that's on like, it's on its final push. It's, you know, it's a few months out from production. It needs X, Y, and Z, or it's going to the actors. It's something that's essentially ready. And I go between the three of them at random.
Amazing.
Until a deadline looms. And then I'm like, oh my God. And then I'm awake for like 48 hours just trying to spell check something.
Well, you've hit a deadline, so we've got another two things still with a go then, I take
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah. No, I do. I'm really, a lot of the stuff that I'm doing, I'm so excited about, and I will tell you about them genuinely. And like one of the musics are a huge piece of it as well. That's a TV series, which is something that it's with Apple. And if it goes,
yeah.
I think it'll be really fun. It'll be really fun to do it differently. And what my plan with that is actually to bring the composer into the writer's room.
Amazing. Because I'm like, no one's ever done that. And it's crazy to me because it's like, if we bring them in there at this stage, one of the main characters in it is a musician and uses music to essentially understand the world.
You need that understanding.
So it's like, have that. I don't have to write so much dialogue. Yeah. They could just do it. And it's exciting. You kind of start to, as you produce, you start to go, what composers do I like? Who do I love? What musicians do I love? And it's really nice to sort of start to reach out. And start to feel like, oh, hi.
Oh, that's awesome. Oh, please come back for another visit then when you
I'll
can talk about it.
Anytime you want. Perfect. Anytime you want.
Next Christmas. Well, next Christmas or maybe before. Who knows?
I don't know. They take a while. I hope it's not 10 years again. That was long.
Please don't know. Listen, thank you for your time. It's so fascinating and just lovely to kind of celebrate all this brilliant work that you've done and evidence to come as well. Thanks, Christy, and Merry Christmas.
Thank you. Merry Christmas.
From The Good Nurse, that's an extract from Biosphere Score rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with the fabulous Christy Wilson-Cairns. Huge thanks to Christy for taking me on for a second time on Soundtrack, and Merry Christmas to you, my darling. The Good Nurse is available to watch now on Netflix, and you can hear her discussing One Night in Soho with Edgar Wright by heading to edithbowman.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are at Soundtracking UK, and please feel free to send me an email about anything you like to info@edithbowman.com. Just to say, actually, at the start of the year, we have a very exciting opportunity for you to attend an exclusive screening of The Fabelmans, which is the brand new film from Steven Spielberg that stars Paul Dano, Michelle Williams, Seth Rogen and many, many more. So we have a competition to give away a pair of tickets to that that we're going to run just at the start of the year. So make sure you stay tuned and look out for that. And I'll be running some stuff on socials as well. So if you ever aren't following us already, make sure you are on Instagram and Twitter at Soundtracking UK. Next up, so excited to have them back. Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross return to Soundtracking to discuss their score for Empire of Light, directed by the aforementioned Sam Mendes, and also their fabulous score for Bones and All with Luca Guadagnino. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then. In the meantime, Merry Christmas!